to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 2nd, 2021. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. From the front page of today's Gazette, coronavirus pandemic forces school bands to improvise. Students and directors explore new ways to connect through music by Diana Nolan of the Gazette. Welcome to the world of high school bands in the pandemic. Masks with flaps, bell covers for brass instruments, puppy pads for spit rags, marching bands that don't march, concert bands with canceled concerts. Pivoting is a hallmark of marching routines, but since March 2020, bands and band directors in the corridor have been pivoting in ways that are anything but routine. Every day brings improvisation. Washington High, Iowa City High, Mount Vernon High, and Prairie High Schools all have 100 more students in band. Keeping them engaged, connected, and practicing became crucial during the first 6 to 9 months of the pandemic before they could tiptoe back into the distanced outdoor and indoor rehearsals and performances. Some band students and teachers still aren't meeting in person because online learning remains an option at many schools. Contest entries, including Allstate, moved to recorded submissions sent to online portals. But all four schools have spring performances in the works, and last fall mounted abbreviated football shows on their home turf after trying to hold modified distance outdoor rehearsals. The first day of Prairie's camp ended shortly before the derecho hit last summer. Storm damage also shut down Washington's rehearsals. City High organized a volunteer football pep band on the blacktop outside the end zone. In Cedar Rapids, Washington, Kennedy, and Jefferson each played for one of their own games at Kingston Stadium. Prairie performed at 2 home games, with an intended third show rained out. Mount Vernon played at 3 home games and at an open rehearsal beforehand, which turned emotional when the parents and guests in the stands gave them a standing ovation. In between fall and spring, the band directors had to figure out a rehearsal model, lessons, and expanded instruction, including in-depth studies of musical styles, composers, and listening exercises, which they said has enriched the student experience. All the local band directors were able to keep their full-time assignments. Aaron Otmar, director of bands at Iowa City High, saw social media posts about directors in other parts of the country being reassigned to teach in different areas or having their programs cut, but he hasn't heard of that happening in Iowa. The disruption has been exhausting for teachers and students, said Scott Weber, 48, of Mount Vernon, the district's 8th grade and high school band director. Anybody in the arts has had to reinvent how you teach. It's such an expressive form of education, a lot different than math or English, said Weber, who is in his 6th year at Mount Vernon and his 20th year as band director. It's definitely opened our eyes to what the potential is for how you can really reach students because you had to do something different to make things happen. But I think our kids are stronger. I think our teachers are stronger because of what we've had to endure, at least for myself. I won't take a lot of things for granted as we move out of this. And I know we're not done, he said, but those moments when you're in the stands and watching other bands perform or you're working with a student and you're working with other colleagues, it causes us to pause for a moment and realize how lucky we really are to be able to do what we do every day. Even when every day has been so different and so unsure. When the pandemic hit, everything stopped, said Jim Miller, 62, of Hiawatha, one of 2 band directors at Cedar Rapids, Washington, where he has taught for 20 years. My wife likes to kid me that you came home for spring break and never went back. He did go back for one final turn in a year like no other before he retires this June after a 41-year career. It's certainly not what I had anticipated, he said, of moving to online instruction. We had to learn the technology to do it. I'm not used to teaching this way, but all the teachers, at least in my building, have become very adept at the Google Classroom suite. And we all know how to sign into group chats and all kinds of things to teach in that format because that's where the kids are. When schools last year went into lockdown, it would have been easy to put band on pause too, but the directors stressed the value of music in student development and began reaching out to their students on virtual platforms to keep them connected to the program and to each other. During a time like this, the arts have really helped our students to really feel in a better state emotionally than if they didn't have the arts in their lives, said Otmar, 28, of Iowa City, a 6-year teacher in his 4th year as director of bands at his alma mater, Iowa City High. There's just so much about what we do that's collaborative, where every person has a part in what the whole product is, he said. Also, it's a natural, soothing, healing, emotional aspect to their lives, as it provides something other than curricular areas may not. It appeals to a different side of your brain, the less analytical side of your brain, and it also appeals to the emotions within your heart more so than some other curricular interests. Obviously, it would have been easy to say, hey, we're not going to do as much this year, but at City High, we really wanted to take the mindset of doing whatever we can to make meaningful experiences for our students. Miller echoed that. There have been tons of studies that have been done over the duration of my career, and they all point to how it helps them become well-rounded and helps them have a varied interest in learning, Miller said. And then there are exacting studies that show that music absolutely helps learning, specifically math. There's a correlation between math and music, as you might expect, and in our school, our philosophy is that we want the kids to be involved in as much stuff as they can be involved in. Finding their footing was tough last spring and summer, and even into the fall, as they faced so many uncertainties about when they would return to school, rehearsals, and performances. All the band directors encouraged students to keep practicing, but they couldn't rehearse as ensembles online because of the sound delay. Turning on their computer cameras and even attending virtual sessions were optional, too. The same kids that would normally practice at home continue to practice, said Daron Jimerson, 45, of Cedar Rapids, co-director of bands at Prairie High. But it's hard. For many kids, the biggest reason they're in band or choir is because of the interaction with other students, the feeling of performing in an ensemble or even rehearsing in an ensemble, he said. When you're home alone, that's a hard thing to recreate, and it was harder to stay motivated to practice, maybe, because you didn't have new music to learn or a performance coming up. For the most part, our kids did a good job of persevering through that and trying to practice new things. Some also branched out while at home. We talked to kids that learned new instruments or spent more time learning guitar, which they might not normally do, said Jimerson, who is in his 11th year at Prairie and 24th year as a band director. We've heard from some students that have tried writing music and learning more about recording. We just try to really encourage them to do whatever they can to stay connected that way, especially last year when all this first happened. There were a lot of virtual concerts and recording things happening, he said. We tried to share as much of that as we could with them so they could keep seeing music and being inspired to coming back at some point. Most schools reopened last fall with hybrid learning, alternating in-person and at-home attendance. That meant band practice on any given day could have a wildly disproportionate number of bodies and instruments in socially distanced chairs. As more students came back to in-person learning, Prairie, Mount Vernon, and City High schools have been able to rehearse in their large performance spaces, making it easier to keep students distanced and to plan for upcoming concerts in May and June. Only the Revolutionist Jazz Band is meeting in person regularly at Cedar Rapids, Washington, since the ensemble is small and the band room is large, said Miller, whose colleague, Joe Nagel, directs that group. But several fine arts organizations will offer up short performances during Washington's popular Frankfurter Festival, slated for May 13th in the school's courtyard. Now the directors are looking ahead to next year. They're expecting to plan football halftime shows, compete, and host contests, and rebuild skills at all levels, especially with the band students in the lower grades, who have missed so much they're just getting started. It will take a little time to feel like we're going back to where we were a few years ago, Jimerson said. We're really trying to focus on what we can do with the kids in front of us each day. You always have that long-term vision. You're always looking forward. And personally, I have an eighth grader who is in band, and there is drum practice and drum rehearsal from my basement twice a week. Also, from the front page of today's Gazette, or the front page section, one-third of Iowans aren't fully vaccinated. State sees 388 new cases of coronavirus. Slightly more than 33% of all Iowans had been vaccinated against the coronavirus as of Saturday. But the state also recorded 388 new cases of COVID-19 in the 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Saturday, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data analyzed by the Gazette. Iowa listed 19,051 more residents having been fully vaccinated Saturday morning. That took the total to 1,042,103, or 33.03% of the population. Linn County had 1,225 more people complete a full series of vaccinations, with 35.18% of the population now fully vaccinated. Johnson County had 1,477 more people complete the vaccination, taking its total to 42.11% of the population. Linn County reported 8 new COVID-19 cases for a 7-day average of 20. That's a drop of 15 from Friday's figures. Johnson County also saw a decline from 24 additional cases to 13 additional cases Saturday, with a 7-day average of 19. 79 more cases for children under the age of 18 were listed on the state's database. The state reported 2 more deaths, bringing the total to 5,950. Both deaths were this month and of Iowans between the ages of 61 and 80. The New York Times database recorded 575,637 deaths nationwide as of Saturday morning. The number of Iowans hospitalized statewide as of 11 a.m. Saturday was down by 2 from the previous day to 189. 44 patients were in intensive care units and 18 were on ventilators. The state has reported only one coronavirus outbreak at a long-term care facility since April 20th. 18 people connected to long-term care centers have the virus, which is unchanged from previous days. Turning to the Iowa Today, what they're thinking, advocates concerned about bills targeting trans Iowans. Keenan Crow says proposals send the wrong message, by Elijah Decius, The Gazette. This year, 15 bills targeting issues relevant to LGBTQ Iowans have been introduced to the Iowa legislature. They include attempts to limit transgender student participation in athletics, prevent transgender students from using a bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity, deny medical care for transgender youth, prevent discussion of gender identity in classrooms, and remove gender identity as a protected class from the Iowa Civil Rights Act. Two have been assigned to a subcommittee but failed to gain traction. One, Senate File 436, known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, would create broad religious exemptions to otherwise generally applicable laws, including anti-discrimination protections, according to One Iowa. The other, SF 80, would require school districts to notify parents of a student's preferred pronouns, if asked. As the legislative session comes to a close, Keenan Crow, Director of Policy and Advocacy for LGBTQ organization One Iowa Action, shares thoughts and observations on the proliferation of these bills. Question: 15 anti-LGBTQ bills were introduced in this legislative session, most of them unassigned to a subcommittee. 13 of them are specific to gender identity issues and transgender Iowans. How does this session compare with previous sessions? Answer: the volume is slightly up, but the volume of anti-trans bills, specifically bills against trans kids, is way up. 2 years ago, we had 2 bills pass. The previous year, we had 14 anti-LGBTQ bills introduced. This year, we had 15 bills introduced, 8 of which were specific to trans kids. This mimics larger national trends. In 2019, there were 35 anti-transgender bills introduced nationwide. 2020 had 100 bills. This year, there were 144. The number of anti-transgender bills has gradually been trending upward. The number of anti-LGBTQ bills in total is down a little bit nationwide this year, 320 versus 342 last year. But there's still a lot of bills. A lot fewer against lesbian, gay, and bisexual folks, and a lot more targeting transgender and transgender children specifically. Question: why do these bills continue to proliferate in the legislature, particularly during a pandemic? Answer: it's a good question and one that I don't have a totally comprehensive answer to. I, of course, can't project people's intent on this. It does seem to be less on constituent concerns and more about what is happening on the national playing field. For example, these athletic bills and trans healthcare bills for youth are almost verbatim introduced into other states as well. They're not bills that legislators are coming up with themselves. These are from national organizations like the American Principles Project or Alliance Defending Freedom. They create this model legislation and send it out to legislators. This legislation has become more and more available, and therefore legislators who are interested in scoring political points against marginalized communities are more easily able to introduce that into state legislatures. The thing that perplexes me most about Iowa is that gendered identity has been covered as a protected class since 2007. People have been able to use the restroom at school or get health care that they need. All of these things have been happening for the last 14 years and not a peep. But this year, because national trends are at play, it's the big thing to talk about. Transgender people are all of a sudden the problem, even though this all has been going on for well over a decade. Back in 2007, the focus was really on marriage. Legislators were largely focused on sexual orientation. It seems like the culture war has moved on from gay and lesbian folks and now is completely focused on transgender individuals, and I think partially just because there's more visibility. Question: which bills concern One Iowa the most? Answer: the most egregious was the one that stripped gender identity out of the Civil Rights Act entirely. But there are definitely offensive pieces in a lot of the other ones as well. Genital inspections for children, that was definitely a component of the trans athletics bill. I get very uncomfortable when I have to talk about that bill because it's just so disturbing. I think RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, has the potential to encourage people to pick and choose which laws they're going to follow whenever it suits them. It also applies to criminal justice situations. So if someone wanted to bring a claim to court that said they're allowed to discipline their spouse and child as they see fit, they could attempt to exempt themselves from domestic violence laws. Obviously, that's necessarily not going to stick, but it certainly encourages people to raise those claims. Question: even if these bills never became law, what are the impacts to LGBTQ Iowans? Answer: anytime a group of people with immense amounts of power is debating whether or not you get to exist in public, it has detrimental effects on your mental health. The Trevor Project, a national LGBTQ youth suicide hotline, reports that when this kind of stuff is introduced, their call volume increases directly with the introduction of these bills. I know folks who have gone back into the closet or have tried to minimize their public interactions just because they're so afraid of being the center of a political debate because they know it's not just relegated to the statehouse. If somebody sees a trans person in public and they know the sentiment is, we don't like these people, this is an out group of people, that raises the potential for violence, harassment, all sorts of things. Question: how do these bills affect the perception of our state? Answer: it has a massive negative impact. Just look at the article in the Des Moines Business Record. There was a venture capital firm having phone calls with other folks trying to convince them to come to Iowa, and they just burst out laughing. That's what happens. Our reputation as a welcoming state really shifts. When I started in politics in 2010, Iowa was regarded as a beacon of civil rights protections in the Midwest. Now we're not. Iowa's unemployment rate is starting to approach pre-pandemic levels, which means that there's going to be a real shortage of workers for the amount of jobs that we have. Businesses' ability to attract, retain, and recruit the top workforce is going to be negatively impacted by this because you're arbitrarily excluding a certain percentage of the population. Demographic trends are not in the state's favor. We know that if we don't recruit folks to come here, that our population is going to start decreasing rather than increasing. That is also going to have a negative impact on our economy. Question. Seven of these bills in the current session are co-sponsored by Representative Jeff Shipley, Republican Fairfield. Another five are co-sponsored by Representative Sandy Salmon, Republican Janesville. For 10 of those bills, either Shipley or Salmon are the only co-sponsors. Is a small faction giving the legislature an unfair reputation on LGBTQ issues? Answer. In terms of the sheer volume of bills, maybe that's true, but we also saw back in 2019 that last-second maneuvering within the last day of the legislative session to strip medically necessary surgical care from transgender Iowans who were on Medicaid. Most folks in the legislature voted for that. Most folks voted for the bill that overturned anti-discrimination policies for student groups. So there is a majority that's willing to entertain these ideas. There are some that are willing to entertain many more extreme ideas. Is that reputation therefore unjustified? I don't know. There's a certain amount of justification that goes into that. Turning to the Insight page, the Gazette editorial, Envisioning Smarter Policing. Other Iowa communities should take notice of new programs in eastern Iowa. Almost a year after a police officer was caught on video murdering a Minnesota man, corridor cities are making progress towards stronger oversight and accountability of law enforcement. The international protest movement that formed in response to the police killings of George Floyd and other Black Americans has led to policy change at an unprecedented pace. Local governments accustomed to years-long reform projects have been forced to take meaningful action. Several months in, a vision for smarter policing is coming into focus. The Iowa City Police Department recently sent officers to be trained in active bystandership for law enforcement, or ABLE, through the Innovative Policing Program at Georgetown University. The training, which all Iowa City officers will undergo this year, teaches strategies for intervening in police misconduct. When the public sees video footage of police violence, like with Floyd's murder, we often are outraged that fellow officers didn't step in. Bystander training encourages officers to be proactive in preventing misconduct. The training is supported by racial justice and civil rights groups, including NAACP and ACLU chapters from around the country. While this type of loyalty to members of the in-group is not unique to law enforcement officers, the consequences of such a culture within the police profession are particularly pernicious due to the number of interactions between police officers and community members on any given day, wrote Catherine Sanderson, an ABLE program advisor, in a recent USA Today column. Iowa City and other local departments recently adopted or enhanced their duty to intervene policies, which require officers to intervene when their colleagues use excessive force. Those policies, paired with adequate training, could help prevent a deadly tragedy like the ones we have seen in other communities. Cedar Rapids this year will become the third city in Iowa to install a board to complaints against Iowa police officers joining Iowa City and University Heights. We are firmly supportive of the city's efforts, but we have some concerns. Membership on Cedar Rapids Citizens Review Board requires significant training requirements. Those selected will have to take a 30-hour course in their first 6 months and an additional 10 hours each year under the police chief's direction. They also must do 16 hours worth of police ride-alongs each year. That's all in addition to regular meetings of the board. For comparison, Iowa City's Community Police Review Board only calls for an orientation briefing to inform members about policies and bylaws. Members are given the option to participate in the city's Citizens Police Academy, but it's not required. Cedar Rapids leaders acknowledge their training requirements are on the high side compared to similar panels nationally, but they say it's necessary for members to know the department's policies and procedures. The hefty time requirement might be a barrier to participation, especially for wage workers and parents of young children. And the police chief's control of the training curriculum might give the false impression that the board is subordinate to the police department, although we expect the board also will seek advice from non-police sources. Encouragingly, the city has already received some 50 applications for the Citizens Review Board, which are being accepted until May 31st. Community members should pay close attention to who is selected and who fulfills their terms as indicators of whether the stringent requirements are workable. Police in Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and Marion are expanding their mental health personnel. Departments are partnering with Cedar Rapids Foundation 2 and Iowa City's Community Crisis Centers to place civilian staff specifically trained to manage mental health crises. Iowa City also has a new collaboration with Shelter House for a street outreach coordinator. People experiencing homelessness, mental illness, and problematic drug use are especially ill-served by the traditional law enforcement incarceration models. They claim an inordinate share of public safety resources, and the system often exacerbates their crises, a lose-lose for everyone. Lynn and Johnson counties have new access centers that provide an alternative to jail cells and hospital beds. the GuideLink Center in Iowa City, and the Mental Health Access Center in Cedar Rapids. Clients can be referred by police or other service providers without an appointment. Staff provide immediate care to stabilize clients and offer referrals to other services. While those projects are in their infancy, they show great potential to enable better use of police resources. Next, Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column, Ernst Court's Conservatives on Criminal Justice Reform. Iowa U.S. Senator Joni Ernst this past week introduced a bipartisan bill to address some of the effects of the United States incarceration crisis. The Clean Slate Act would, for the first time, automatically seal records for certain drug offenders and create a path for some other offenders to apply to have their records sealed. If passed, such a policy would help former prisoners get jobs, lead productive lives, and avoid reoffending. The problem is that many Americans continue to pay for their crimes long after they've completed their sentences. People with criminal records are sometimes treated as second-class citizens, excluded from employment, housing, and educational opportunities, even though most pose no serious threat to the public. Under current law, even an arrest without a conviction can be a permanent demerit. Ernst's bill, which introduced to coincide with Second Chance Month and National Reentry Week, is narrowly focused on low-level, nonviolent drug offenders. It specifically excludes people convicted of violent crimes and sex offenses. It would apply only to federal charges, while most crimes are prosecuted at a state level. Even after paying their debt to society, oftentimes those who have been charged with low-level, nonviolent misdemeanors face significant barriers to employment, housing, and other necessities, Ernst said in a statement. Ernst is co-sponsoring the bill with Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Casey. A bipartisan duo in the U.S. House plans to introduce a companion bill. Similar federal legislation has been introduced at least twice before, attracting mostly Democrats as co-sponsors. Ernst is part of a growing conservative consensus in favor of criminal justice reform. In addition to some of the usual progressive organizations, Ernst's bipartisan bill is backed by a long list of right-wing advocacy groups and think tanks, including Americans for Tax Reform, Business Roundtable, Faith and Freedom Coalition, R Street Institute, Right on Crime, the American Enterprise Institute, and Freedom Works. Conservative justice reformers see healthy reentry to society from prison as an economic issue. Criminal records are a barrier to gainful employment. There's no better way to address recidivism than a good job. The Clean Slate Act gives those who want a better life for themselves an opportunity to succeed by empowering them to move past a mistake they have made, Adam Brandon, Freedom Works president, wrote in a statement supporting the bill. Most people who commit serious crimes have already had some involvement with the criminal justice system. Nearly three-fourths of those convicted of federal crimes have a criminal record with an average of 6 previous offenses, according to U.S. Sentencing Commission review of 2016 data. That suggests that local, state, and federal correctional systems aren't actually correcting offenders. Instead, getting caught up with the law for a minor offense often triggers a spiral into more serious crimes. It's a waste of resources, and it makes us less safe. Sealing records is great, but it would be better to stop making so many criminal records in the first place. The Clean Slate Act is only a partial fix to a set of problems the government plays a large role in creating and exacerbating. Drug and public order offenses are common on-ramps to the criminal justice system. Decades of overcriminalization and extreme sentencing policies have helped create the biggest jailer state in the world, incarcerating a higher portion of the population than any other country. If we close some of the on-ramps to the system by downgrading criminal charges and fostering alternatives to incarceration, we might prevent vulnerable people from going on to commit more serious crimes. Blood and treasure would be saved. If we really want a clean slate, our next step should be to wipe clear the overgrown criminal code. Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Doorman, Puddle Police Are Coming. Bureaucrats are coming for Iowa's farm puddles again. Okay, not really. But as the Biden administration surveys the environmental wreckage left from our previous occupant, we're starting to see the same old dishonest sludge being spread by Republican members of Congress from Iowa. They're trying to muddy the waters on dirty water. In 2014, when the Obama administration introduced its Waters of the United States rules, or WOTUS, the sludge machine swiftly kicked into its highest gear. Regulators, who were basically trying to clarify the Clean Water Act to reflect new science on the consequential water quality connections between small streams, groundwater, wetlands, and larger bodies of water, were painted as an existential threat. Iowa U.S. Senator Joni Ernst declared that WOTUS would allow a tire track that collects rainwater to be regulated by the federal government. Ernst and others insisted the rule would allow the feds to regulate 97% of Iowa land, a figure cooked up by the Iowa Farm Bureau. Truth is, the vast array of the Clean Water Act exemptions for agriculture that existed before WOTUS were included in the new rules. The specter of regulators probing farm puddles was a lie for political effect. And of course it worked. Farm groups, big business, and developmental interests found in Donald Trump a candidate more than happy to peddle their nonsense about WOTUS, along with his personal brand of dishonesty. As president, his Environmental Protection Agency scrapped WOTUS and rolled out the far narrower Navigable Waters Protection Rule. Trump's rule left half of the nation's wetlands unprotected, allowing developers to fill them in without fear of federal interference. Many smaller waterways and ephemeral streams in the West were left out. Irrigation canals that could carry livestock waste to vegetable growing operations, not included. The EPA's own science advisors panned the Trump rules, arguing the agency didn't provide a scientific basis for refusing to address the hydrological connectivity between wetlands, groundwater, and navigable rivers. But as the push against WOTUS shows, none of this is really about science. Now the Biden administration is looking for a way to scrap the Navigable Waters Protection Rule and put together its own package of clean water safeguards. The president ran on addressing environmental problems, after all, and won a non-stolen election. Complicating matters is the Trump rules are tied up in court fights. But luckily, we have some new members of Congress to take a fresh look. Under the WOTUS rule, the federal government would have authority to regulate water on 97% of the land in Iowa, said 2nd District U.S. Representative Marionette Miller-Meeks in a statement earlier this month, announcing a renewed GOP push to stop any new water protections. She's leading the charge. The NWPR is much more workable and keeps our water and land clean without destroying businesses in the process, Miller-Meeks said. Bureaucrats who have never set foot in Iowa shouldn't regulate ditches and puddles on farms, tweeted 1st District U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson while vowing to stand with Miller-Meeks. Together, we're pushing back on yet another attempted Washington power grab that would only make it harder for Iowans to farm, ranch, and build, added Ernst R. Tiretrack. I'm not sure why people bother to run for Congress just so they can become cookie-cutter party drones, apparently drained of curiosity and ready to adopt any tired talking points, but it happens all the time. And you've got to love concerns about confusion coming from politicians doing all they can to confuse us. But all the water carrying on water is appreciated. The American Farm Bureau Federation applauds the efforts of Representative Miller-Meeks to support the Navigable Waters Protection Rule, which provides a balanced approach to protecting our nation's waterways and wetlands while providing much-needed clarity and consistency for farmers, ranchers, and regulators, said Zippy Duval, president of the American Farm Bureau Federation. The Farm Bureau and other large agricultural and agribusiness interests that back these fine public servants believe they can't afford to let regulations get through, no matter how little they actually affect farmers. What if an effective national effort to protect water catches on? What if voters want more? Who knows what could be next? So carpet bomb everything, conjure up bureaucratic boogeymen, and send public officials out to lie to their constituents. And what's better for America, a strip mall or wetland? One justification for the narrower Trump water rule was that states surely would fill gaps in protection. Iowa Republicans and their allies, of course, also don't want real water protection at the state level. They don't want to protect Iowa's lakes from algae bloom or rivers from the overapplication of nitrogen fertilizer or even our most outstanding streams from manure spills and runoffs. Farm in the floodplains, build as many livestock confinements as you want. Don't like it? Plead with the environmental protectors for help. Watch them shrug. Better take it up with the puddle police. And turning to the community letters and the political column from Jack Oman, who is a syndicated cartoonist distributed by the Post Writers Group, we see a space capsule orbiting the Earth and a quote attributed to Michael Collins, 1930 to 2021. The quote from Michael Collins is, I really believe that if the political leaders of the world could see their planet from a distance of, let's say, 100,000 miles, their outlook would be fundamentally changed. The all-important border would be invisible, that noisy argument suddenly silenced. The first letter is from Gretchen Ree Robinson of Mount Vernon. Iowans should see vaccinations as a privilege. To laugh or cry, Iowans are declining coronavirus vaccines. I'm so thankful I've received one dose and am scheduled for my second. To receive a vaccine is a privilege. Seven of our family members were ill with the virus, and two had long-term effects. Once the medical community began getting their vaccines, we were hopeful. Remember that feeling? Coronavirus infections surged with terrifying speed in India, as reported recently in the Gazette. Also reported, Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley's statement, Iowans want their medical freedoms protected. Iowans, I respect your medical privacy 100%, but I don't know what medical freedom is. Governor Kim Reynolds, wanting to have and eat her cake, tells Iowans she respects that it's a personal choice while also asking previously, what are you waiting for? Medical freedom, is that like live free or die? Or is medical freedom access to quality medical care for all Americans, regardless of your ability to pay for it? At the risk of offending your personal choice, Iowans, vaccinate yourselves. It's an American privilege. You should be so fortunate. Gretchen Ree Robinson of Mount Vernon. Next, Elwood Garlock of Cedar Rapids writes, Hinson needs to speak out against Matt Gaetz. Currently, Florida Representative Matt Gaetz is under investigation for sexual relationships with a 17-year-old girl and child sex trafficking charges. This is incredibly concerning. Why has my congresswoman stayed silent on this issue? In September 2020, Ashley Hinson ran a campaign ad on her record targeting sexual predators in Iowa. It states, in the Iowa State House, I wrote the law to hold bad teachers accountable for misconduct In Congress, I will fight every day for our kids to learn in a safe and positive environment. Protecting our children from predators extends beyond the walls of a school. Where is the accountability for Gates? If she wants to hold predators accountable, why isn't she leading the charge to hold Gates accountable? Hinson needs to speak out on this and uphold her campaign promise to fight for our children. Elwood Garlock of Cedar Rapids. The next letter is from Charlie Wishman, president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. It's time to hold employers accountable. In 2020, American heroes in grocery stores, the U.S. Postal Service, hospitals, and more became known as essential workers, and many of them had to risk their lives by working in unsafe conditions. As the coronavirus continues into 2021 and deadly workplace risks remain, there has never been a more important time to give workers more voice and power. Research shows that nearly 60 million workers would join a labor union if given the opportunity, so why haven't they? For years, policymakers, lobbyists, and CEOs have stopped at nothing to keep worker power at bay. They weaken the National Labor Relations Act. They attack collective bargaining rights. Under current law, the penalties against employers who illegally fire or retaliate against workers who are trying to form a union are a drop in the bucket. As a result, employers routinely retaliate against pro-union workers because they know it will undermine the organizing campaign and they will face no real consequences. To them, it's simply the cost of doing business. For the first time in modern history, however, we have the chance to turn this around. The Protecting the Right to Organize, PRO Act, would hold employers accountable and institute civil penalties for violations of the law, including back pay and damages. The PRO Act would put the decision of whether or not to form a union back where it belongs, in the hands of workers free from employer interference. That was Charlie Wishman, president, Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. The next letter is from David Dewar of Iowa City. Disturbing flag is a reminder of the struggle for equality. Driving through Solon recently, either on my way to one of the good restaurants there or en route to the southeast side of Cedar Rapids, I've noticed a flag being flown by some person on Market Street. Its left half is the stars and stripes, but its right half is the Confederate stars and bars. Of course, that citizen has a legal right to make such a statement. Likewise, I have a right to express my strong disapproval and disgust. The combination of these two flags suggests the union of the ideals of the United States of America with those of the Confederate states. In the case of the latter, those ideals were focused on continuing the inhumane and unjust institution of chattel slavery. I struggle to express how profoundly disturbing it is to see this flag flying. Perhaps it must serve to remind us how very far we have to go to achieve our nation's foundational belief that all human beings are created equal. David Dewar of Iowa City. And the final letter is from Therese Grant of Grinnell. Young Iowa voters should not be declared inactive. There is something terribly wrong with the recent election laws that require the Iowa Secretary of State's office to send an inactive notice to nearly 417.5-year-olds. These young people, who were not old enough to cast a ballot in the November election but could register to vote, are now listed as inactive. For a young person to receive this type of notification can be extremely discouraging. This requirement has a negative effect on these young people and could easily disenfranchise potential voters who are typically eager to cast their first vote. Changes need to be made in this requirement so that our young people will be empowered to vote in the future. Therese Grant of Grinnell. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 2nd, 2021, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn to the obituaries. From Cedar Rapids, Betty M. Carney, age 86, died Friday, April 30th. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center of Cedar Rapids handling arrangements. Linda L. Bulow, 73, of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 28th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital. A public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 4th, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories Stateroom. A public service will be held at St. John's Lutheran Church in Center Point on Wednesday, May 5th at 11 a.m. with a visitation at 10 a.m. For many years, Linda ran her own daycare. In her free time, she enjoyed baking, cooking, decorating cakes, and catering local events. She also enjoyed singing, shopping, and camping with the Kettleson Camping Group. She cherished the time spent with her family and friends. Esther H. Christensen, 84, of Cedar Rapids, passed away in the early morning of Tuesday, April 27th. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 5th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, May 6th, at Humboldt Union Cemetery in Humboldt, Iowa. Esther spent about 20 years as a stay-at-home mom before returning to school to obtain her accounting degree from Kirkwood Community College. Thereafter, becoming a working wife and mother. She was a dedicated member of First Congregational United Church of Christ, serving on committees and women groups, attending Bible study and prayer groups, singing in the choir, and playing handbells. Esther was a proud member of the PEO. Esther with her husband Charles were yearly season ticket holders at the Cedar Rapids Symphony. They spent several years helping to establish and support the local chapter of the Antique Automobile Club of America. Loris Anthony Callahan, known as Tony, age 84, of Marion, passed away on Friday, April 30th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place. There will be no visitation. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 5th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, conducted by the Reverend David O'Connor. Tony worked as a test technician for Rockwell Collins, retiring in 1991 after 32 years. He was a member of St. Joseph Catholic Church and Marion American Legion Post 298. He was a big Irishman, serving on the Sapodapisope Committee organizing and participating in many St. Patrick's Day parades in Cedar Rapids. Tony loved calligraphy, fishing, and was a good cook. He helped with the barbecuing at the St. Joseph Fun Days. Tony will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved him. Michael R. Merritt, known as Mike, age 73, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, April 24th at his home. Services 2 p.m. Friday, May 7th at Stonebridge Church by Pastor Brandon Levering. Burial, Maple Hill Cemetery, Montour. Per COVID-19 guidelines, attendees are asked to wear masks and practice social distancing. Mike worked in ministry and counseling for the Navigators. During this time, he served as a missionary in the Philippines for 10 years. Annie Lee Mullinex, 77, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, April 24th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life gathering will be from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, May 15th at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Linda G. Pattison, 76, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Saturday, April 24th at her home. Linda will be laid to rest with her son Christopher at Floral Memory Gardens, Albany, Georgia. Tea and Funeral Home of Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Linda loved antiquing and spending time working in her garden, tending to her flowers, especially her roses. She was well known for the beautiful, detailed ceramics she created. Linda's heart was always filled with love for her family and her dogs, Molly, Randy, Sugar, May, Sarge, and Nikki. Lorna Anna Johanna Reek, born Lorenz, 93, of Luzerne, passed away peacefully at the Vinton Lutheran Home on February 17th after a brief illness. A celebration of Lorna's life will be held from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, May 8th, at the Blairstown Community Center in Blairstown. Alan Leon Stiers, known as Al, 86, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, April 22nd. A joint celebration of life for both Al and his oldest son, Steve, will be held later this summer at Lovely Lane Methodist Church in Cedar Rapids, date to be determined. Al attended the Drake Relays even after retirement and kept busy with his beautiful custom woodworking. He was a very skilled craftsman. He was a wonderful husband, dad, friend, coach, mentor, and beloved member of Lovely Lane Methodist Church. Sonia Vassar of Cedar Rapids departed from this life on April 19th in Jacksonville, Florida, with her family by her side. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. May 8th at Lifeline Ministry Church, 1101 Oakland Road Northeast, Cedar Rapids. Sonia was a jack-of-all-trades outside being a loving mother, sister, grandmother, and friend. She was very handy when it came to fixing things. If she could not fix it, she would find a way. Sonia was always planning and looking ahead at how to best provide or make a way for those she loved. If she had it, Sonia would make sure to share with those she loved and those in need. Gregory P. Aubrey, 68, of Ejimsville, Maryland, and formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away on April 27th. Greg moved to Maryland in the 1980s and worked hard toward a successful career as a mortgage loan officer. He was passionate about bicycling, and his family takes comfort in knowing he spent his final moments doing what he loved most. He deeply loved his home state of Iowa and had planned to participate in the annual Ragbri 500-mile biking excursion across the state this summer. Greg was active in Boy Scouts and took pride as an Eagle Scout. Dr. David Pease Carew, Professor Emeritus of Medicinal and Natural Products Chemistry in the University of Iowa's College of Pharmacy, passed away on April 26th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. He was 92. Dr. Carew lectured worldwide on plant tissue culture and was named a fellow by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Pharmacists Association Academy of Pharmaceutical Research and Science, and the Academy of Pharmaceutical Scientists. Teaching and leading his undergraduate and graduate students were his true passions. As a result of his work, Dr. Carew received the University of Iowa's Marion L. Hewitt Award for dedication to, concern for, and interaction with students, as well as the Michael J. Brody Award for exceptional contributions to the UI and the community. Mary E. Calkins of Marengo, age 86, passed away on Thursday, April 22nd, with family members surrounding her. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, May 8th, at the First United Methodist Church, Marengo, with Pastor Lisa Crow officiating. Interment will be in the Marengo Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, May 7th, at Closter Funeral Home, Marengo. Loy Gibbs, known as Fact, age 87, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, April 28th. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, May 7th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will take place at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, May 8th at the funeral home. Entombment will follow at the Linwood Cemetery Mausoleum in Cedar Rapids. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Fat moved to Cedar Rapids and worked for Kiekaefer Paper before entering the military. After serving the U.S. Army, he went back to Kiekaefer Eddy Paper, later known as Weyerhaeuser Paper, and retired in 1990 as a production manager. Fat was a member of the VFW and the Moose Lodge. He enjoyed bowling three times a week in the senior league at Lancer Lanes. Carol Ann Brokel, age 87, of Mount Vernon, died peacefully in her home on April 26th. Carol's proudest achievement next to her family was working to the age of 81 after retiring from over 50 years as part of the administrative staff with Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Carol was a fixture on the Cornell campus and the matriarch of West Science. Her dedication to the college was exemplary. Whatever you needed, whether that be typing and proofreading a manuscript, proctoring an exam, planning an annual picnic and holiday luncheon, welcoming students, or simply listening and giving advice, Carol provided. She loved every day she spent at Cornell and regretted the day of her retirement. Rosemary Marie Koblenz, known as Rosie, age 93, longtime resident of Oxford, died Saturday, December 26, 2020, at the Lantern Park Specialty Care Center in Coralville. A time to gather to celebrate Rosemary's life will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, May 8th at the Oxford United Methodist Church. Private burial services will be at the Oxford Cemetery. Thomas Gene Hutchcroft, 78, of Montgomery, Texas, passed away April 15th. He was in marketing product management and retired in Montgomery, Texas in 2015. He enjoyed living in the Bentwater community and spent many hours in the back patio. He loved grilling in the outdoor kitchen and playing golf with his friends. Margaret Sue Wallace, born Margaret Schlacke, known as Sue, of Marion, passed away at the age of 89. She taught fourth grade in Ames Public Schools, and then after attending AIB in Des Moines for one session, she became secretary to Dean M.D. Hessler, who was the director of student affairs at Iowa State University in Ames. She also helped the foreign student advisor in that same office. Visitation for Sue will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, May 3rd at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A private burial service will be held at First Presbyterian Church in Marion. Following the continued guidance from health officials, physical distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people allowed into the visitation at one time. And it is with great sadness that the family of Gary Lloyd Steger, 71, class of 1967, Washington Senior High School, Cedar Rapids, share that Gary passed away suddenly on April 6th, 2021. Gary created GLS Research, Inc., Market Research Analysis in San Francisco, California, where he brought his talents to many private and public arenas, including the gaming and tourism industry of Nevada and the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority, as well as to premier advertising and marketing firms such as R&R Partners, as well as to Native American nations alike, all of which continue to take him around the world to fulfill his duties. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Turning to the sports page, Mike Loss's column, Time for Iowa Football to Explode in a Good Way. Running back Goodson says Doak Walker Award is his goal. Here's what can be said with conviction about the Iowa football team now the spring practice has ended. With Tyler Goodson at running back and Tyrone Tracy Jr. at wide receiver, shame on the Hawkeyes if they don't take full advantage of those two talents this fall. Tyrone's going to be Tyrone, Goodson said Saturday after the Hawkeyes opened practice at Kinnick Stadium. He's a playmaker. You put the ball in the man's hands, you never know what he's going to do. We like to call ourselves TNT because we like to be explosive, and he's every bit of that. Very explosive, and he's going to be great for this team. Tracy was held out of Saturday's scrimmage, but the public got a good enough look at him 2 weeks earlier at the other open workout of the spring at Kinnick to love what it saw. And Goodson, I want to be the Doak Walker Award winner, he said. In the word of Jerry Seinfeld's Uncle Leo, hello! We have little actual verbal meat on the bone from the Hawkeye football camp. You see, the first unanimous first-team All-American in Iowa State history will be a junior this fall, and he happens to be a running back. Breece Hall was so good last year that he got most of the Cyclone snaps at running back, though they had Kini Nwangu, a good enough runner to be a fourth-round NFL draft choice Saturday. Hall rushed for 1,572 yards in 12 games last season, 5.6 yards in a carry. He scored 23 touchdowns. Like Iowa basketballer Luca Garza, who was presented the Naismith Award at Kinnick Saturday, Hall gets the bump from big numbers the previous season. Goodson wasn't a garden-variety RB himself in his sophomore year last season, accumulating 762 rushing yards and earning first-team All-Big Ten honors. Bring on September 11th when the Hawkeyes play at Iowa State. Is there a Hall-Goodson rivalry? Not yet. Is there a Hall-Goodson friendship?
We probably have no relationship at all, said Goodson, but I would like to get to know him a little bit and see what he's about. I feel like he'd be a pretty cool guy to hang around with. Hall plays with one of the nation's top returning quarterbacks in Brock Purdy. High-level quarterback play is one of the things Iowa needs from Spencer Petras to do what Iowa State did last season, which is reach a conference championship game in a major bowl. Petras got a baptism under fire as quarterback, but his last four games were his best four games. Offensively, the Hawkeyes should at least be as good last year as when they averaged 31.8 points playing nothing but Big Ten opposition. Center Tyler Linderbaum is nothing less than great, and the rest of the offensive line is some promising players. Tight end Sam Laporta may make it TNT plus Sam Kablam. He's a difference maker, ready to enter the George Kittle, TJ Hawkinson, Noah Fant ionosphere. So go ahead and put the burden of expectations on the 2021 Hawkeyes. It's time Iowa won its second Big Ten division title in 11 tries and first since 2015. One league championship game per decade isn't the ratio you're looking for if you're a top 25 program, which Iowa has been at the end of the last three seasons. The Hawkeyes were as good as anyone in the Big Ten West last year, but that didn't translate because they lost their first two games. By December, the Hawkeyes were 6-2. They would have been 8-2 had their hastily scheduled game with Michigan and their Music City Bowl against Missouri not been canceled because of COVID-19 issues with both opponents. This is 2021, with vaccine available to all, fans back in McKinnick stands, and a clean slate. Oh, and there's also a West Division without a team that should intimidate Iowa like last year. The Hawkeyes have TNT at running back and wide receiver, the running back tells us. His team should blow up in a good way. It's time. And in wrestling, Ironman moves on, wins title at Nationals, by K.J. Pilcher of the Gazette in Coralville. The past is in Jaden Ironman's rearview mirror, and he is accelerating forward. He said the NCAA Finals loss in March has driven the Iowa senior and Hawkeye Wrestling Club member since his return to training the following week. It provided enough fuel to propel Ironman to the 143-pound men's freestyle title at the USA Wrestling's Senior Nationals last night at Extreme Arena. He scored the final 8 points to defeat Oklahoma's third-seeded Dom Demas 8-4 in the championship match. Once I got over that finals loss and got it behind me, it just lit a new fire underneath me, Ironman said. My performance today was good, but it's nowhere near where I can be. Ironman transferred to Iowa to help with his international career. The gains are leading to rewards, keeping him in the running to make the U.S. world team later this year. I'm excited, Ironman said. My goal is to be a world and Olympic champion, and to get by that, I have to keep getting better every day. Ironman held his top seed, improving his 2019 runner-up finish. He overcame a 4-0 deficit in two of his last three bouts, including the one against Demas. A turning point came after Demas scored 2 exposure points for a chest wrap, doubling his lead. Ironman quickly regained his composure, earning a point for seizing control. Ironman went to work with 2 leg lace turns for a 5-4 lead at the break. In the second 3-minute period, Ironman seemed set for a push-out for 1 point, but finished before the edge for a 2-point takedown. He added a push-out late. I just needed to get on top and get going, said Ironman, who used turns to beat Demas in 2019. Mat awareness is huge in these matches because of criteria. There's no overtime, so you have to make sure everything is good. HWC member Pat Lugo finished 3rd in the same bracket and is eligible to compete in the World Team Finals. Iowa teammate Tony Cassiope also reached the finals. He placed 2nd to top-seeded Nick Gwadzaki. Cassiope was the 10th seed and knocked off number 7 Derek White, 4-1, number 2 Dom Bradley, 5-1, and number 3 Ty Waltz, 11-1. Panther Wrestling Club member Taylor Lujan earned a title at set 174.5. He won by forfeit over former Illinois star Isaiah Martinez. Lujan beat number 2 David McFadden of Virginia Tech, 11-4, in the semifinals. Former Iowa State NCAA champion and Waterloo East 2-time state champion Kyvan Gadsden reached the 2-2 finals. He fell to top-seeded Nathan Jackson, New York Athletic Club Princeton, 6-1. The Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. In the news, teens death impetus for legislation. The Iowa House voted unanimously to make it a crime to fail to disclose the location of a body with the intent to conceal a crime. The impetus for the bill was the death of Noah Herring, 15, of Tiffin in Coralville Lake in April 2020. Although 3 teens and an adult were present when Herring drowned, none of them called 911, and they withheld information about his disappearance, delaying the discovery of his body for 4 days. Vaccine passports. The Iowa House approved legislation to ban vaccine passports that would require the disclosure of whether Iowans have received a COVID-19 vaccination. The bill would prohibit state and local governments from producing ID cards with information regarding whether the cardholder has received a COVID-19 vaccination. Vaccine hesitancy. Iowa health officials said Tuesday that 80 of the state's 99 counties declined some or all of their COVID-19 vaccine doses for next week, showing the demand for immunizations is dropping dramatically. Broadband funding. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said she and top legislative leaders have agreed to invest $100 million in new state funding for initiatives that seek to expand broadband internet access to underserved areas of Iowa. They said, I'm a big believer in perfect not being the enemy of the good. However, it doesn't come close to perfect or really even good. Representative Jennifer Const on changes to the Iowa bottle bill. And unfortunately, I don't get everything I want. Governor Kim Reynolds on the likely failure of her proposed E15 fuel mandate. Odds and ends. Affordable housing. A Senate budget subcommittee unanimously approved two housing assistance initiatives designed to advance access to affordable housing for Iowans and provide relief during disasters. Health budget. Iowa lawmakers are considering a $59 million increase in funding for health and human services for the coming fiscal year, once again pushing total state spending over the $2 billion mark for that budget. Prison attack. A correctional officer at the Anamosa State Penitentiary was attacked by an inmate April 24th and received medical care for bruises. The attack came about 1 month after two prison employees were killed at a facility some call overcrowded and understaffed. Road construction. The Iowa Department of Transportation is urging drivers to slow down and pay attention when traveling through work zones as the summer construction season gets underway. Haley returns. Nikki Haley, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, will attend the Republican Party of Iowa's summer fundraiser. Haley will attend the party's Lincoln dinner on June 24th. Child care. Following up on her executive order to create a task force to develop child care strategy, Governor Kim Reynolds announced two virtual town hall meetings on child care, May 6th for parents with children in care and June 1st for child care providers. Iowa holds on to four seats in Congress. It appears Iowa will hold on to its four U.S. House seats for at least another decade. The first results of the 2020 census released Monday confirm a dramatic shift in population as Americans leave northern Rust Belt states in favor of sunnier climes where economic opportunity is more plentiful, according to the Census Bureau. Iowa's population grew nearly 4.8% in the past decade, from 3,046,355 to 3,192,406, the Census Bureau said. Threats defense. An Iowa man charged with leaving a threatening voicemail telling Governor Kim Reynolds she should be hung for treason defended his comments as free speech, saying he's expressing opposition to COVID-19 restrictions. Governor's security. The state will pay $400,000 to design and build a wrought iron fence around the historic Des Moines mansion used as the residence for Governor Kim Reynolds, and the fence will be installed soon around the Terrace Hill property, officials said. Unemployment benefits. Iowans who lose their jobs would have to wait 1 week before they would start receiving unemployment benefits under a bill that won initial Iowa Senate approval, despite complaints that it would be a kick in the teeth for Iowans in crisis. And the time machine section for today, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Kent State Anniversary. Shootings of Students, Unpopular War, Spark Protests in IC and CR, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. It's been half a century plus 1 year since four students protesting the Vietnam War were shot and killed at Kent State University in Kent, Ohio, on May 4, 1970. Deaths that inflamed protests and riots across the country, including in Iowa. The Vietnam War appeared to be winding down in accordance with President Richard Nixon's campaign promise to end the conflict. But then on April 30th, Nixon announced the U.S. invasion of Cambodia. Protests erupted across the nation May 1st. At Kent State, the Ohio National Guard was called in to stem violent confrontations. The soldiers arrived in time to see the ROTC building ablaze. A May 4th rally on the campus commons attracted more than 3,000 people. Tear gas was fired into the crowd, and soldiers began marching through the crowd to break it up. At the top of a hill, some of the guardsmen turned and fired, most firing into the air or the ground, but some firing into the crowd. Four students were killed and nine were wounded. At the University of Iowa, about 400 protesters, angered by Nixon's announcement, marched into an ROTC award ceremony at the recreation building. Armed with sticks and throwing eggs, they tore off a door and broke in, disrupting the event. The campus returned to calm until the May 4th Kent State shootings. A crowd of up to 700 gathered and began to march to the armory, where windows were broken and park benches were used as battering rams to try to break down the doors. Dispersed by police, students moved to the Iowa Civic Center, two blocks away, where some began throwing rocks and eggs. Other protesters headed for the old Capitol, but police got there first, so the protesters headed downtown, where windows were broken in about 13 businesses. Out of the almost 19,000 UI students, an estimated 3,000 were active protesters. Of those involved in the demonstrations, 250 to 300 were described as militant, and 30 to 50 as actually destructive, the Gazette reported. The demonstrations over the next few days resulted in University President Willard Boyd saying he would use emergency powers to suspend any student violating school conduct rules. By Sunday, May 10th, Boyd was contemplating a student senate request to close the university for the rest of the semester. Their request followed two fires on campus, one destroying the old armory, temporary, and the other damaging a restroom in East Hall. Boyd made a surprise appearance at an evening student rally and said he could not close the university or end ROTC programs, but told students he believed in them. He gave students the option of taking a pass grade, assuming they were passing their classes on May 3rd, and leaving campus. More than 11,000 of them did just that. At Coe College, a peace vigil involving about 100 students began May 6th in front of the Linn County Selective Service Office in a Guaranty Bank building. About 48 hours later, the demonstrators packed up their belongings and walked back to campus singing, "We Shall Overcome." A year later, the memory of Kent State was still raw a year later when anti-war protesters organized a May 5th convocation and march on the Pentecrest in memory of the Kent State students. The march erupted into a melee when a service truck driver drove into the crowd, hitting three protesters. Suddenly, rocks were flying through the air, hitting cars and buildings. Police and state deputies arrived by busloads and began arresting people. On May 7th, the Iowa City Civic Center was damaged by a bomb. Student leaders reacted by ordering protesters to remain on campus. "It's time to cool it," one person said. "This bombing has got the city so uptight that civil protest on city property would really be asking for it. We're better off to stay on our own turf." In Cedar Rapids, about 125 protesters, identified as high school and college students, gathered May 5th at Coe College in Green Square and marched to the federal building in peaceful protest. And that brings us to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Sunday, May 2nd, 2021. You can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recordings anytime on our website, iowaradioreading.org. I've been your reader, Sharon Felton. Thank you.